finish it, but tonight I think we should have time to take one last run in to where we've left off in this chapter and hopefully finish up tonight as we... where we're moving toward in just a moment is a comparison of Revelation 17 with Daniel chapter 7. We'll be there in just a moment. And a quick run through of what we spoke of last week, just so we're kind of at the same place. And as I do this review, if there's anything that has not been clarified yet, please feel free to ask about it. But I'm just going to pick up in chapter 17. We need to just read the text here, verses 7 through 14, that describes the beast upon which the woman has been riding. We've identified the woman here, this great prostitute, is the city of Rome. And now we're told about the beast upon which she's riding. This beast that we've identified, this is the beast that's come out of the sea in chapter 13. We've identified this earlier in our study as essentially the political power of the Roman Empire centered in her emperors as she persecutes the church. And let's just read here and then we'll do a quick review and pick up where we left off. But the angel, this is 17:7. But the angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with seven heads and ten horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast because it was and is not, and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come, and when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. And the ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called chosen and faithful." Couple of things by way of review. As we're looking at this beast, John is told something rather important, that the beast was, that the beast presently is not, and the beast is about to come up out of the abyss, out of the pit, which would communicate to us, if we're thinking of the beast as the persecuting power of Rome centered in her emperors, that we're at a point in between two persecutions of the church. That the persecuting power has been, currently is not as active, and is about to resume. And so that's kind of the kind of one of the backdrops here of this whole chapter, is this... the situation about the present state of the beast, and basically referring to a resumption of persecution through the emperors that has been left off for some time. We're told in verses 9 through 11 that the seven heads that we read in Revelation have two meanings, seven hills, and we've talked about the seven hills of Rome, and they are seven kings, we've been told. And of those seven kings, John is told, five of these kings have fallen. One of them is presently. One is about to come, but he will stay only for a short while. And then the beast is an eighth. We're told he's of the seven. He's part of this power structure. He is of them, but he will go to destruction. We're then told in verses 12 through 14 that the ten horns that we don't have up here, these are different horns. We do have 10 horns, but they're different horns. The 10 horns in this picture, the 7 heads and the 10 horns. The 10 horns are the client kings who are supporting the Roman Empire, who along with the whole power structure of Rome will persecute the church, but will ultimately be defeated. So we left off kind of looking at these particular kings of the Roman Empire in the first century. And we've talked about, I won't go through this again, but we've talked about why we're looking at this literally here as well as figuratively. So often in Revelation, all of our numbers we've been looking at figuratively, except when the text seems to give us specificity to them, like the seven churches of Asia are actually named, and we know that though the number seven may have to do with perfection, yet we're told seven churches and we're given the names of seven churches. So we see that there's a symbolic value, but also a literal nature of the seven. And that appears to be, and that's the way we're viewing, in our study at least, the seven kings that are talked about as the seven heads. And we've kind of, last week, in looking at these, here are the kings that we're going to be looking at in the Roman Empire that are based here. We did note, and I think this is on page 43 in your notes, that this, if we're looking at this right, this gives us a little better, a closer idea of when Revelation was actually conceived or written or revealed to John, because we're told that five of the kings have fallen. And if we have this right, I believe we do, but if we have these right, we're told that five kings have fallen. These kings are no longer have ruled and have gone. And we'll get back to these three in just a moment. We're told that one is, that would be this king, Vespasian the emperor. That one is about to come and will reign for a short time. That would be Titus, who rules just 2 years. And then the eighth, Domitian, would be the reoccurrence or the coming back to life of the beast in persecuting the church. If that's right, when John is told one is, that's present tense, the one that is Vespasian. And what that would indicate to us is that John is this vision is being given to John during the reign of Vespasian. That this is the timing of the actual vision. The vision has to do with the soon-to-be resurrection of persecution against the church in the time of Domitian, but that the revelation is given to John just prior to that. So there's a it would be kind of a way of indicating a date of the writing. And essentially, as we look at these kings and this language about the beast, and we're told, for example, that the beast is an eighth, and we're also told that the beast was, I think it's, when we look at first century history as it regards the church, the persecution begins chiefly under the emperorship of Nero. After Nero's suicide, that stops. And then the persecution of the church begins again under Domitian. And so what we would be, in looking at that and going back up here to this, the beast was active during the days of Nero persecuting the church. At this point, the beast is not. Vespasian is not persecuting the church the way Nero did. Not in this direct way of enforcing emperor worship. But the beast is about to come. The beast is about to come, and we're told that that will be in the eighth king, that the beast will return and the persecution of the church will resume. And I think that pretty well brings us up and hopefully consolidates what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. Let me ask for any questions of clarification or any kind of question or comment as well. Anything at all? Yes, sir. Yeah, and that's a... Exactly. Why not start with Julius Caesar, perhaps, or with someone else? And page 46 in your notebook, in that handout, Steve Singleton makes a case for that by talking about Augustus being the first who takes the particular title of princeps, that Augustus is the first who rules under the empire rather than the republic. And so you have a shift there. I think lists, when you look at lists of emperors, some of them start with Augustus. I think it's the kind of the same thing when we get to these three in a minute. Some of the, I don't think that the lists are necessarily 100% consistent, though I don't speak from any real first-hand knowledge on that. But the backwards way of arguing was, well, it fits a lot better. if you want to back into it, you say, well, yeah, it fits a lot better if you start with Julius Caesar, this whole theory. But we're not trying to, we're really trying, obviously, not to juggle these things so that they fit with our theory, but really trying to make sense of them in a first century setting. And so that's a good, someone could dispute that and say, well, you know, I'm not sure I accept Augustus being the first emperor. And they could make a case, perhaps, for Julius Caesar being the emperor. If so, then this understanding is obviously wrong. It would be off. It wouldn't fit. If you start with someone else, and I'm surely not an expert on the emperors of Rome, but I think they're, you know, I think on page 46, Singleton mentions some, because I think he mentions both, some lists and some references, ancient references that start with Augustus, and some that don't. So, but that is a good question. I mean, and we're just kind of assuming that, obviously, here. Yes. Yeah, I think the marvel there kind of goes back to, I mean, in just these descriptive terms that we've seen in Revelation. In chapter 13, when this beast rises up, there's a certain, I think it's a matter of marvel in the sense of seeing its power, seeing the way it makes its stamp on things. And, you know, earlier it's like, you know, who can stand against the beast? You know, seeing the power behind this empire and behind the demands. That there's, you know, it's just, I think it's just a way of describing that people recognize the power that that the emperor and that this whole system has, you know, within the history of the time. Yes. Yes. As far as this is not, what we're saying is the beast is not, which covers this entire time frame, and then the beast returns in the eighth king. So you have a gap from what, 68 down to, is it 81, I think. When Domitian begins to rule, where you don't have the same level of active persecution. Whoops. That's how that breaks, Tim. Don't let Mike see that. He just bought us a new microphone. I don't even know how that happened. Well, I sort of do. Let's just put it in my pocket. How about that? I didn't notice anything. I don't know. Let's compare Revelation 17 and 13 now. We've been talking about this for quite some time with Daniel chapter 7. That's kind of the last little step we need to make here to kind of finish off this point. I think it's fair to say, in the many views that are taken of the book of Revelation, as far as I'm aware, every view would agree that whatever is being talked about in Daniel 7 is being talked about in Revelation. Now, they might, those different views might say it's talking about different things, but there's a connection between Daniel 7 and the book of Revelation that I think every view of Revelation sees. And that's what we're going to look at tonight and make the connection, because I think it's just an important connection between the prophecies of Daniel and what we're reading about here in Revelation. And in your notes, that's on page 44, I think, the comparing them. We're just going to... It's a bit of a lengthy text, but I think it would just really help to just read through it and see the connections here. Daniel's vision is taking place toward the end of the Babylonian Empire. Daniel 7, it's in the first year of Belshazzar. And let's just read the opening of his vision of the four beasts. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea." Just as we're reading through, do you notice four winds, great sea? Do you see? I mean, just to see very similar language in apocalyptic writing. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first lion had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And it was told, "Arise, devour much flesh." After this I looked, and behold, another, like a leopard, with four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. We're going to get to the identification of these four beasts in just a moment as Daniel interprets it. But I would just, it's kind of hard not to at least mention it superficially. From Daniel's perspective, Daniel is looking at the rising up of four world empires. The Babylonian Empire, in which he's presently living, the Medo-Persian Empire that will soon follow, the Greek Empire, and the Roman Empire. Those are the four beasts that he sees. These four kingdoms are spoken of in several prophecies in the book of Daniel. This is just one of them. You remember the statue? The head of gold? Remember the silver breastplate? You know, working your way down, the legs of bronze, the feet of iron, and or the legs of iron, the feet of iron and clay, the four kingdoms that are coming. The one thing I would just point out here is that the kingdoms that are described here are referred to as the first is like a lion, the second is like a bear, and the third is like a leopard, and the fourth isn't really described at all, if you'll notice, at least except for some horns at the end. If we go to Revelation chapter 13 and read about the beast coming up out of the sea, you'll remember that the beast coming up out of the sea is described with those same animals, only in reverse order. The leopard, the bear, and the lion. And essentially, what we're seeing, and I think there's pretty much agreement on this across the board in comparing Daniel and Revelation, is Daniel is living here. This prophecy is somewhere in the maybe 540-something B.C. He's looking down toward the time of Christ, and he sees these four kingdoms coming all the way down to the first century. When John writes, John is kind of looking back over that time period. And so you have the beast in reverse order, but the beast that is coming up out of the sea in Revelation, the enemy of the church, is a beast that encompasses all of those powers that came before it. And so you have John looking one way, Daniel looking the other. Rome is the culmination of the kingdoms that have preceded it, and it is powerful. It's different from those that are before it. This 11th horn, we're going to come back to this in just a moment, but there are 10 horns, and an 11th pops up, and it speaks arrogant words. It has eyes like a man, and it talks like a man, and it's arrogant. And then the Ancient of Days begins to reign in verse 9. The Son of Man is given dominion in his vision. So you see God coming, and you'll see the beast, the dominion of the beast is taken away, and the dominion of the Son of Man is established. And then in verse 15, we're going to jump down and see the interpretation. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of things. These four beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever. So notice that Daniel is being told that there are kingdoms that are going to come in succession, but that the true kingdom and the true dominion will belong to the people of God. That the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever. Think about that language as we come to the book of Revelation and hear the things that are being said to the church as she faces her enemies. So keep that in mind, and it's at this point that Daniel wants to know about this fourth beast. And here's what he's told in verse 19. Then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet, and about the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn that came up, and before which 3 of them fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things and that seemed greater than its companions. As I looked, listen to this language in verse 21. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them until the Ancient of Days came. And judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. So this horn is making war against the people of God until God comes and judges them, and the saints are shown to have the kingdom and the rule. And he goes on in verse 23. Thus he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which shall be different from all the other kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth, and trample it down, and break it to pieces. And here what we're saying is we're talking about the fourth kingdom, which in Daniel's perspective is Rome. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He will be different from the former ones and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. That language probably stands out to us. That image of a time, times, and half a time, that's the period of persecution in the book of Revelation that the church is undergoing as we have powers coming against the church and how the church has been given over into the hands of her enemies. Verse 26, but the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion shall serve, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. And so here we read about a persecuting power coming against the people of God. And we focus specifically on this 11th horn, which is a king. And this, I would point out that in Revelation, the kings are called heads, seven heads with an eighth. Would point out just a reminder that this beast that has seven heads in Revelation also has ten horns, but there the horns represent the kings who are supporting the Roman Empire. In this image and in this vision, there are ten horns that we're told represent kings, and an eleventh horn comes up, and this is the boastful horn. And what Daniel is told in the passage that we just read, and I think this is page 44 toward the bottom, that this 11th king will be different, that he will put down three kings, that three kings are going to be torn up before him. He'll speak words against the Most High. He will wear out the saints. He will war against them. He will prevail over them for time, times, and half a time. And he will do so until the Ancient of Days comes. Then he will be judged and lose his dominion and be destroyed. And the kingdom and dominion shall be given to the saints of the Most High. And his kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom. What we've just been told in Daniel completely parallels what John is showing us. And as we begin to look at it, though there's a difference, I think they both come to the same conclusion. There's a question that no one can answer. Well, God could answer if he chose to, but I don't think any human being can answer the question. And let's just kind of start with it. We have 11 horns. But then what happens to three of them? They get plucked out. If three horns get plucked out of 11, okay, you might have to take your shoe off for this, unless you happen to have like that giant in the Bible has six fingers on each hand. If you take three away from 11, if we were going to renumber this whole thing, number 11 now becomes a number 8. The question is, why does Daniel have 11 minus 3, and John has 7 plus 1? And I have no idea. I have no answer to that question. Steve Singleton on the handout mentions a couple of things, that maybe Revelation is just simplifying the Old Testament vision. Daniel has shown one thing, John's shown another thing. They're compatible with each other, but they aren't exactly the same thing. And so basically what we're saying is, you'll notice we do not have these three kings listed, but we do here. Here they are, numbers 6, 7, and 8. In case you were wondering the three who get ripped out, that's my choice, let me rip out those three. And this is where it mentions on the handout as well that these three, after the death of Nero, Nero commits suicide. There's a bit of a scuffle for power in the Roman Empire. And over a period of about 18 months, these three guys are all vying for power. Some lists of Roman emperors include those three, and some lists don't. Because they never completely are established as emperor in the sense that the other rulers are. And there's some lists that just go from Nero to Vespasian and leave out those three. And here's where all I can say in answer to the question is, for some reason, in the imagery of Revelation, what John is shown of the beast, we have 5 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 to give us 8. In Daniel's account, we have 11. 3 are taken away, leaving us with number 8. In both cases, it's number 11 and number 8. And number 11, who essentially becomes 8 if you take 3 out, who is the persecuting power against the church. And let me just look. On page 46 there, I'm just trying to Take a look halfway down the page. There's a bullet that says the counting of the kings should omit Vespasian's three rivals to replace Nero for the following reasons. I won't give you a second to get to page 46. It's a really nice little one that I didn't do, the one that I photocopied. Despite the reigns of Galba, Otho, and Vitellius, each ruling briefly as the official emperor, none successfully consolidated his power. Their terms combined lasted only a year and a half. Secondly, many ancient and modern authors skip over these three in the enumeration of the emperors, and he mentions some sources there who do that. Number three, the omitting of these three rivals of Vespasian seems to be another example of Revelation's simplifying. It's hard to put together Revelation is simplifying something, but Revelation's simplifying the Old Testament imagery. A, Daniel 7, 7 through 8, and its interpretation in verse 24 speaks of 10 kings plus one king minus three kings, leaving a total of eight. Revelation 17 seems to omit the three, making the symbolism simply 7 plus 1 equals 8. That's the most concise explanation that I've come across for that. And here's the... let me just say this. Whatever view of Revelation a person subscribes to, whether a person's a dispensationalist or whatever point of view, classic premillennial or whatever, you have, this is the reality for everybody. Okay? If you're a dispensationalist, you see these as being the same. You have a different explanation than we're giving, but the connection between Daniel and Revelation is the one thing, as I said, that pretty much everyone agrees on. And as you read through Daniel 7, you can see why. You're coming down to a fourth kingdom. This is a kingdom that persecutes the church. You have a king who's speaking boastful things, who's making war against the saints for time, times, and half a time. Very, very, very parallel language to what we read in Revelation. And so whatever Daniel is talking, is being shown in his vision, John is being shown in the vision that he has in Revelation. Let me stop for a second just to get any questions or thoughts or anything. Please feel free. I may not have an answer, but please feel free to ask or to make a comment. Or yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and really, for me to say that those are the three that are plucked, I mean, because the vision doesn't really make any deal, or the vision in Daniel doesn't really specify which three, because in one case it just says they're plucked out, and then it almost implies in one that Domitian was a part of that. However, Domitian is the son of Vespasian. These are his two, Domitian and Titus and Domitian are Vespasian's sons. And so their father coming to power, in a sense, would have been the undoing of those three. Maybe in that sense, that would be a way you could see how those particular three, if that's what we're meant to make of that image in Daniel, because it's pretty obscure, the reference there. But if we are to identify it with those three, and why, how would they be plucked up? It would at least tie in with the dynasty that we're going to be dealing with in the persecution. So there would be a sense in which at least Domitian's father would have displaced these three by coming to power. Although, I mean, I think one of them displaced the other until Vespasian came along and took over. That's a good question. I really appreciate questions. I hadn't thought about that, and it just, I really appreciate it. So if you have a question, you think, please ask it. Like I said, we may not have an answer for it, but, I'm not going to wait forever here. So, go ahead, Kylie. You do have a dynasty, yeah. Is it... I don't believe so. I think Nero is the end. Is it Flavian Dynasty? Is that? I can't remember if this is the Flavian Dynasty or if this is the Flavian Dynasty. But you know, the one is the there is a dynastic connection, and then there is afterwards. But in between, I don't think there is. I really don't know for sure, but I don't think there's a connection with the. Okay, Kylie is saying is that another way of discounting essentially the importance of these three is they are kind of inserted for a very brief period of time between two dynasties that do have significance, and so in a sense they could be in the Revelation view omitted as being unimportant. He likened that to stories, even in the Gospels, that sometimes include more details than others or have different details. And but that's a good thought. I appreciate that. That's a very good thought. Essentially, what all of this does is connects the Old and New Testament prophecies of this particular time and shows the persecuting of the church coming back into being shortly in Domitian. And remember then the imagery of the head that's been slain but comes back to life, kind of the resurrection of the beast. And in this sense, the beast that was and is not is about to come. There's a sense in which that's a parody of the resurrection. And the beast itself will rise up again, and people will marvel that the beast, and maybe that's another aspect of the marveling, is the beast has come back to life. And there are connections, at least in the second century, between Nero and Domitian, Domitian being called the bloody limb of Nero, for example, as kind of the rebirth of the persecution. Yes. Yes. Candy's saying that if, assuming that we've got our ducks in a row here, that if the writing is during this time and people who are alive have known about the persecution here, that it would be somewhat terrifying to contemplate the return of a persecution even worse. And I think that's a good point to make. And as we read through the book, a couple of thoughts. One, the fact that the beast is not during this time frame is not an indication that the church wasn't being persecuted on a variety of levels. Because, again, if our timing is right, we have John on the island of Patmos for the testimony of Jesus Christ during the reign of Vespasian. Perhaps not because he hasn't worshipped the emperor, but for some reason he finds himself in trouble with at least the authorities in Asia Minor and finds himself in exile. So there's persecution throughout this time frame, but the sense of the kind of the really focusing of the imperial persecution of the church as it regarded emperor worship and that sort of thing, that would be the kind of what is being foretold, and it would be a difficult thing to anticipate. And you can see then in the imagery of the book with the souls that are under the altar, back in chapter 6, after the fourth, I think the fifth seal is opened. The souls under the altar saying, "Hey, how long before you do something?" It's like we've died. we're martyrs, and what does God tell them? There's more to come. Nothing's going to happen until the number is filled. There are going to be others that are going to be joining you before God takes his action. And I think as you read through what we've already read through with kind of this in mind, I think you get little hints along the way that things are going to get worse, that worse things are on the horizon, that's kind of a part of what's unfolding in the trumpets, for example, the seals and then the trumpets, that things are going to get worse. The end of this in chapter 17, verse 15. Well, notice verse 14. They, that is, the beast and the kings that are allied with the beast, that is, the kings that are in alliance with Rome, they will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with Him are called chosen and faithful. And the angel said to me, "The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the ten horns that you saw," these client kings that we just talked about, "these ten horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out His purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth." I wanted to read that and just mention briefly what's being referenced here. And we'll pick up with chapter 18. If there's a thought on this, we can definitely take a look at it. But we're told that the waters here, again, are peoples and multitudes and nations over which Rome rules. But then we're told that in the future, these very kings, these ten kings associated with Rome, with the seven heads, these ten horns, these very powers are going to be a part of the destruction of the city of Rome, and even the beast itself. And what we're kind of getting a heads up about, and I'll just say it, and then we'll summarize that and get to chapter 18 at the beginning next week, is that part of the way that Rome will eventually fall will be brought about by the very powers that supported her. These very kings, these very nations that have been a part of this confederation and empire will eventually turn against her and will be a part of her downfall. The text says that God will put it into their hearts. And so that part of the falling of this empire will be internal. The very things that have held it together will eventually tear it apart. And if you'll think back, just something that's probably in your memory bank, in Daniel chapter 2, when Daniel sees that statue and you get down to the fourth level, which is Rome, if you remember the feet of that statue, they are iron mixed with clay. And Daniel is told something about a certain lack of ultimate stability in that empire. That it will not be completely cohesive. And I think that's essentially what we're being told here, that part of this, the destruction of this empire, will come from the very forces that have held it together. The very kings that will give their power to the Roman Empire, or the Roman Emperor, to persecute the church, will one day turn against them and will be a part of the powers that bring about the dissolution of the empire. And with that announcement, chapter 18 is a woe or an oracle about the fall of the city. And if you'd like, in preparation for next week, pick out your favorite oracle against Babylon in the Old Testament. We probably don't have many favorite oracles against Babylon, but you can read Isaiah 13, Isaiah 47, Jeremiah 51. Just look through like Isaiah or Jeremiah till you see oracle against Babylon. Just find one or look in your notes. They're referenced there. Read one. And what you're going to read there is essentially what you're going to read in Revelation 18. This is just an old-fashioned prophetic oracle about the fall of a city. And we'll pick up there next week.
Thank you so much. And let's close with prayer. Father, we thank you for being with us in our study tonight. And Father, we continue to pray for clarity and understanding. And also, Father, we recognize that in all of the details and all of the images that we come across, that the ultimate truths are very clear. And that is that you reign, that the Ancient of Days rules the nations of the earth, that the Son of Man rules the nations of the earth, that your people will always be vindicated, that you will always deliver your people to life and to ultimate victory, regardless of the circumstances we face on earth. And Father, that message continues to encourage us as it has your people through the centuries. Help us not to get so caught up in the minutiae of these images that we miss the simple and powerful truth that you are the sovereign of the universe and that you will vindicate and give victory to your people. And for that we give you thanks through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.